Ladies and gentlemen, get ready to embark on a journey like no other. Welcome to the Glum Lot Podcast,
your go-to destination for a unique blend of recovery and discovery.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Mark. And in this podcast, we will endeavor to create a safe and uplifting space for our guests and listeners to share their stories with sincerity and a touch of humor.
Remember, we are not a glum lot. The Glum Lot Podcast is more than just a source of entertainment. It's a beacon of hope, proving that even in the darkest moments, recovery is possible. Every story we share carries the power to inspire positive change.
So buckle up, get ready to listen, and join us in discovering the strength that lies within every individual's journey. This is the Glum Lot Podcast, where humor meets hope. All right, Brett, we are on episode 25.
God.
Yeah.
That's a quarter of a century. I beat you to it.
Well, I was going to say a quarter of a hundred because that's a little more accurate, but whatever, whatever.
How long is a century?
It's 100 years.
It's just a context thing.
Let's fight about it.
Oh, yeah, I'm ready to go. I'm right.
Well, Jesus. You know, I just wanted to let everybody know out there at the Glum Lot Podcast community to please join our Facebook group, the Glum Lot Podcast, on Facebook. And if you want to email us, it's at theglumlotpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah.
So what's on your mind?
It was a heavy one tonight. Just, you know, we're doing this after a meeting tonight. And, you know, sometimes it's, man, it hits you hard when you see somebody that's going through so much, right? And,
yes.
And tonight, this particular person was definitely going through some stuff. And, you know, it just reminds me of where I came from and the stuff that I've been through, but I've been able to overcome and mm-hmm. get through.
Yep.
And so, you know, as much as I felt troubled at first, I was like, wow, I think he's actually going to stick around with us.
I hope so, because there is no answer you can give him that's going to make it all better.
Nope.
There are just things you can say to point him in the right direction so he can go through it.
Yeah.
You know?
And, you know, it hit me good because it had, it was very similar to what I've been going through lately.
Right.
And, you know, the amount of love in that room, it's just, you just don't know until you're in there and, mm-hmm. and one of these topics comes up. The love of everybody for each other is, it's emotional. It's just nowhere else do you experience that. And I experienced that very same thing from yours truly when I was going through one of my most difficult times this year. And how thankful I am, you know, for this program and the people involved with it. You know, the selfless.
And you know what's funny is looking at it from the perspective of an AA member who hears of someone with problems, You're thinking, well, of course I'm going to help this person.
Right.
It's a given. Of course I'm going to, you know, talk to them about it. Of course I'm going to share my experience, strength, and hope with them. That's why I'm here.
Yeah.
And although there are no easy answers and everybody has to go through what they have to go through, boy, it makes it doable.
Yeah.
You know, it really does.
And then you think about, you know, in this particular topic, an outsider would have been like, you deserve that.
There'd be, you know,
almost.
How about sitting on a bar stool and bringing it up to the person next to you?
All right. Yeah, even
you know?
Better.
Right. They're going to tell you that you're reacting to everything is right.
And have another.
And you're going to have another. And you should fight.
Yeah.
You should go over there and tell her what you think.
Oh, raise hell.
Yeah. So, you know, we learn, we've called this a design for living.
Yeah.
And boy, it really is. And never is it tested so much as when you're in a situation like this guy was in.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Because,
yep.
you know, when the feelings are hot and the emotions are high and the anxiety is hot, it's like you got to put all the tools in front of you and say, all right, I'm going to use these and I'm going to see what happens. And if you do use them and you use them well, you're going to find that it was painful, but it worked out.
And at the end of the day, the amount of love in this program is just unbelievable.
Yep, yep. So. And, you know, we have a guest tonight that's full of love.
Oh, definitely.
Yes.
I just recently had the pleasure of going to lunch with him.
Okay.
And, you know, every time I have conversations with people, that love builds. And, you know, I'm mm-hmm. just thrilled to death that he agreed to come over with us and have a talk.
Okay. Well, let's welcome him right now.
All right. Peter!
Peter, welcome to the Glum Lot Podcast.
Thank you very much.
All right. So we're glad you came in today, and we're going to start at the beginning. Let's start with your sobriety date.
My sobriety date is December 16th, 2022.
Okay. So you are fairly new on the sobriety day, but not even close to new on being a part of the program. So why don't we rewind all the way back to the early days.
In the beginning.
Do you remember your first encounter with alcohol? Was it a kid or a teenager?
I don't remember. I mean, what I like to say is I've been powerless over alcohol my whole life. I grew up with a couple alcoholic parents that were functioning alcoholic parents. My mom was a nurse, a hardworking woman. My dad worked a lot, traveled a lot in his job. So the first drink, I don't remember the first drink because it could have been the beer when I was a kid in the backyard. It could have been sneaking the cups at the parties they used to have.
Yeah.
I remember my first drunk.
Very well. Let's hear that one.
All the details.
How old were you?
15 years old.
Okay.
Me and a buddy of mine somehow, and I don't remember this detail, got a hold of a bottle of Scotch whiskey.
Okay.
And so we thought that should work. That should do the trick. Now, prior to that, I've gotten a buzz, you know, from those little after-party drinks and stuff like that. But we went out in the woods to try the real deal here.
The woods.
And I remember sitting there vividly to this day after about two or three sips and getting that first buzz, that real good buzz.
Yeah, that warm, relaxed.
Going, this is going to be a problem for me. Yeah. I like this.
Yeah.
I like it a lot.
And you know what? I wonder what more would feel like.
Mm. Well, so we did find that out. Mm. My buddy and I ended up drinking that whole bottle.
Oh, my gosh.
And that night, my dad came home to find me passed out on my bed with my clothes on in vomit. It was terrible. It was just terrible.
He knew what was going on.
He knew it immediately. Fortunately, he was also out drinking, so, you know. I don't know. It's hard to be sitting there being lectured by a drunk about how you're not supposed to drink and I'm too young for this and blah, blah, blah. If the neighbors weren't sleeping, you'd be out cutting the lawn right now. I mean, it was a tough drink. And I remember the recovery time was at least 3 days on
that. Oof.
The sick part was I couldn't wait to do it again.
Yeah.
The one thing was it would never be Scotch whiskey again. To this day, the
smell. Well, that was the whole problem. It was the Scotch.
It was the Scotch.
You know? Can't smell it, huh?
But it's funny how you say that feeling hits us and we're instantly thinking, this is how I want to feel all the time. And then things get shitty and you're like, well, that's okay. I just want to go back to the part where it felt good.
Nope.
You know?
That's just the normal cost to have that.
I hear a lot in the rooms, people drinking because of fear, people drinking because I loved getting a buzz.
Yeah, me too.
I just loved, and I was always chasing getting a buzz.
Yeah.
And it started, you know, in high school, really. I was an athlete, so I worked out and I ran and I did all, I played sports, I played soccer, I ran track. But on weekends, we drank a lot of beer, but we still got up and did it. And that was normal because I grew up with alcohol around me all the time.
Yep, so did
I. You know, the dysfunction was normal. There was no dysfunction.
It appears to be normal because that's how you grew up.
Have no point of reference.
And I'm assuming drinking age was 18 too?
It was 18 at that time.
Guys.
And so we were able at 16 to be going in with our 18-year-old buddies. I mean, drinking back then was easy.
Right.
Drinking and driving most of the time, if you got caught, meant the cops took your beer and kicked you on your way.
Yeah.
I mean, it was terrible. Which will bring me, you know, so my drinking was sort of like the normal high school partying kind of stuff.
Did it devolve further or progress?
It progressed because as I chased that buzz, it took more and more beer. My tolerance for alcohol started at a very high level and continued to get higher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I remember on our graduation party at high school, I don't know if you ever guys ever shot beers where you punch a hole.
Shotgun.
Shotgun. Yeah.
I did.
Shotgun. What do you think, amateurs?
Okay. I forgot who I was talking to. I did a six-pack of Talls before the party started. I said, this is how the party will start. And it's just off and running. And that was the way I drank.
Should have used a funnel.
The funnel wasn't really around when I was young.
I couldn't do it.
It wasn't really around when I was young.
No, I couldn't do it.
But so the drinking, to me, was normal. I was going to high school. I was getting decent grades. I was playing sports. I had friends. I had a girl. You know, all the stuff.
And drinking was part of that,
right? And guess what? I'd never heard of that first step back then. But I'll tell you right then, back then, I would have said the first part of that step, Yeah, yeah, I can't control my drinking. When if I'm going to start drinking, it's got to be all the way, or I didn't drink. There were times I wouldn't drink at all because I knew I couldn't get enough.
Right.
Mm. If I went to a party, I made sure I had a stash somewhere, because if you ran out, I had to make sure I was going to keep it going.
And did you go to college?
I went to college, and that's where I first discovered drugs.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I had a buddy who was
higher education.
Well, he was a chemistry major, and back then, this is back in the 70s, he was making crystal meth. He was in the lab.
Breaking Bad back
he
then.
He was right? Breaking Bad.
Damn.
And what I discovered is if I snorted some of this stuff,
I could drink
right through the weekend.
Yep.
And I'll never forget this. I remember vividly waking up on a Monday morning. I had a class, and I said, I got to do a couple lines. I'm not going to get going. And I stopped, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm turning into a drug addict. I got rid of the drugs. Alcohol never struck me that way. But the drugs.
Wow, just like that?
It was. And I never, well, I shouldn't say that. I did some of the, I tried hallucinogenics and things like that. But anything that was, I deemed like speed or narcotic that was addictive, I never tried.
Right, you didn't want to become a drug addict.
I didn't want to be a drug addict because there's a stigma attached to that, right? Well, alcoholics are fine. My dad is a businessman. He's an alcoholic.
He's a
my
very
mom's
successful
an RN.
Alcoholic.
She's an alcoholic.
She's a nurse.
You know, my grandfather was the town drunk, and I knew all about it because everybody told me about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the family that you grow up in.
Was his name Otis?
No, but
sorry.
It could have been. It could have
so
been.
So you're going to college. You're drinking ramps up. It doesn't slow down.
It doesn't. And one of the stories I like to tell, I played soccer in high school. And in high school, I was pretty good.
Yeah.
It was the classic. And when I got to the college level, I barely made the traveling team. And I'll never forget this. Our very first year, freshman year, we went there 3 weeks before school started. Three practices a day in the middle of August. It was brutal. And our coach made it really clear. There's no drinking. There's no pot. There's no smoking. There's no screwing around. We're, you know, everybody got it. It took me 2 days to find the other guy that will go with me to go get some beer. And we got caught and we got punished for it. But again, that was my mindset. But the story that I always remember is I was not that good and I struggled to even stay on the traveling team with these guys. And one night we were playing a local school and they said, come on with us. You're going to go with us. Yeah, whatever. As I'm walking out, a buddy had a bottle of tequila and he and I did three shots before I got on the bus. I said, I'm not going to play. Right. So I'm sitting on the bench with a nice budge going, this is a good way to watch the game.
Yeah, I got front row center seat.
Well, the guy in front of me got hurt, and I got called up.
Oh, your worst nightmare.
It was a nurse. But today I look at it, I remember reading in the big book, and it just stuck out to me. You know, missing those opportunities because alcohol took it away from me.
Yeah, you went from dribbling a ball to dribbling on your shirt.
Exactly. And those instances came up a lot in my life.
So did you not perform well in that game?
I did not.
That was a bit Logie.
And you know,
Logie, nice.
It was all up here too. It was like, what did I do? Oh. It's like, you know, and I got pulled out quickly and they found someone else to finish the game for me. But so after that, I did get a job in the steel industry. And the reason I got it, when I was in the summers, I was working in a steel warehouse, and then I started driving a truck. And at one point, I thought, man, I could get into just driving a truck cross country and smoking pot and drinking beers. This would be the life. But I did, when I got out of school, they said, what are you going to do now? I said, I don't know. So I got a job as an outside salesman. And then we were buying steel from a large steel mill, and I got a job with this large steel mill. When I met these guys, I knew I want to work for a steel mill. It's one of the oldest continuous running steel mills in the country. They made a great product. They had a great history. And I got a job with these guys. And we had a warehouse in Auburn, Massachusetts. I grew up near Boston, and Auburn was there. And I started in inside sales, and I worked my way up, and I got a job as an outside salesman. I got to back up, actually. In 1983, before I went there, I got my first DWI.
Because
DWIs
are tell us about that.
Important. So yeah. DWI, it was St. Patrick's Day, 1983.
Well, of course.
Driving down the Mass Pike, coming back from South Boston, had a lot of Irish friends that I had to party with. Got stopped by the Massachusetts State Police. It was a female trooper. Her last name was Ryan, so I said, well, I got that going for me. She took me to the back of the car for field sobriety tests. I fell over the guardrail, rolled down the hill, came walking back up and said, should we continue? She said, I don't think so.
It won't be necessary.
Off we went.
She said, can you fall and roll in a straight line?
So we got back to the station. I didn't know what the laws were. This is 1983. You know, I'd been stopped so many times before and let go. I said, the worst penalty was they took my beer.
Right, but the times they were a-changing.
Well, they were changing. Yeah. And I was in the midst of it. And then when I blew like a 283, they put me in the cell, which was very scary because there was a drunk Jesuit priest in the bunk next to me, and he also got tagged for DWI night. So that was my first encounter with really feeling the effects of alcohol. Remember, now, that first part of step one, I always knew, no.
Yeah, that wasn't a surprise.
My life is still manageable. This was the first thing where now life become unmanageable because you don't have a driver's license. You have to get a lawyer and all that
stuff. When you went into court, did they do the whole thing where they evaluate you and they want you to seek some kind of treatment or classes? Or
I'm a good salesman. And yes, they did. And the answer is they decided after they evaluated me that I need to go to Al-Anon because I came from an alcohol path.
Because
they
of your family.
Sent me to Al-Anon. I blamed it all on my mother and my father and my history.
Okay,
I said, I'm not a drunk. Look what I grew up with. Come on. I must have been good. But here's the downside to that. When you walk into an Al-Anon meeting and sit there and then at the end of the meeting ask them to sign one of those court papers, I thought I was going to get lynched.
They just looked
at me and said, what are you doing here? You're here because of court. I went back to the guy and I said, I'm not going anymore. And he said, fine. And I, free and clear. So in 1987, I went to work for this company. In the late 80s, I got a job as an outside salesman for this company.
Now that means you're traveling, right?
I'm traveling.
Oh,
I'm
windshield
covering
time.
Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine in two parts of Massachusetts. In the 80s, it was a dream job.
Now, that DWI scared you straight, right? You're not drinking anymore.
No, I was drinking. It's funny you say that because I did have to go to some classes, I guess, defensive driving or things like that. And then you get out of the class and go to a bar and half the class was in the bar. And you just go, that's the way we took it back then. That's the way I took it. I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a driving problem.
Of course.
I hear that all the times in the rooms. And I drove drunk so many times, I just messed up this time.
And you know, the same thing with the unmanageability is I just got unlucky. I was a victim of circumstances.
That's it.
I just got to be, if I'm more careful, I'll be fine.
Yep. So I got this dream job with the company that I love. I went from inside sales, got promoted to outside sales, got a great territory. I mean, I love the outdoors. I'm a nature guy. I have in Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. At that time, the defense industry was dominant up there. They were building ships and airplanes and everything. I had in all through my drinking, I was always a high performer. I mean, I got up with hangovers and went to work.
So you were like your father.
I was like
my father
was
the same
mom.
Way.
Yeah.
Oh, it didn't matter. If I had a job. I mean, I'll tell you this story. As an outside salesman, I used to finish my day as much as I could in Concord, New Hampshire. Because at 4 o'clock at the Ramada Inn in Concord was happy hour, dollar for a bottle of beer. I would sit in the payphone area. Back then, there were no cell phones. And just spend 2-3 hours drinking dollar beers and following up on sales calls, setting up the next sales calls. And, you know, as soon as the beers went from $1 to $3, I'd head home. That was, I think, 7 o'clock. I was living with a woman at the time who was more of a drug addict than an alcoholic, but never didn't really care in the condition I'd come in, usually.
Right, so you weren't accountable for that.
I wasn't accountable at all. I was performing in my job. So one of the things I learned as an outside salesman that I used to do is find the customers that like to drink and make them the last call of the day.
Yeah.
And then you pull them out with you and you're drinking on your expense account. Because I didn't like to steal. I did have a conscience all the way through. If I was going to go drink on my expense account, I really need to have a customer
and
with me.
Also, there's that camaraderie. Did that usually result in a successful sale?
It did.
Usually.
Yep. Alcohol was the social lubricant.
It was.
Yeah.
Well, in this case, I was at in the town I lived in Hillsborough, New Hampshire, there was a big GTE Sylvania plant, and I knew the buyer there, and I knew he liked beer, and there was a bowling alley across the street, so 4:30 I headed there, 5 o'clock we were across drinking pitchers in the bowling alley. He left way before I did, but, you know, fast forward, this turned into my second DWI.
Oh.
Tell us about that. What happened?
This was in 1990, March 1990. I'm leaving this bowling alley. I have no idea. It's probably 2 in the morning. You know, I would been there since 5. This was what I did. You know, I was one of those guys who made the promise to myself, I'm only having 2, and then I'm going home. And, yeah, it was 2, except that was the time. It wasn't how many I had.
2 wasn't the amount. Yeah. It was the time.
It was the time. So I'm driving home. I only lived 10 miles from this bowling alley in Hillsboro, but I got stopped. So I remember the first DWI, my lawyer said, never take the breathalyzer test. You don't do that. Okay. Well, this is 7 years later, and the law has changed.
Yes.
So I didn't take the test, and I lost my license for 6
you
months.
You will lose
automatic,
your license.
Yep. Automatic. And so I'm sitting there going,
well, hell.
I'm an outside salesman with no driver's license. This is not good. So I got a hold of my boss and started hemming and hawing that I'm going to resign and this and that. And he finally got out of me what's going on. And I just said, I got a DWI. I don't have, and I laid it out to him because he knew. I mean,
right.
He
it
knew
wasn't
I,
a mystery.
No, it was the company functions. Again, back then, drinking at a company function was much more acceptable than it is today.
Yep.
So people didn't look at you as like they would today, I don't think. So bottom line is, because the person who was president of my company at that time was a recovering alcoholic, he was also a very service-orientated guy. He started a rehab in the area that this company was in. And so my company was very pro EPA and helping people, particularly with addiction issues. I was lucky. As I get going from this point forward, my higher power was all over me. I mean, I shouldn't even be here. And so in March of 1990, I ended up in a rehab on Cape Cod. I remember calling him, going, "You're in Falmouth. There's a really nice golf course. Should I bring my clubs with?" No.
It's not like that.
You know, the reality before I walked through the doors, I was going down there to figure out my next move. Yep. This was going to buy me another 28
days. Right. So
you
didn't really want to stop drinking.
No.
You just wanted to get out of trouble.
I knew I had a problem.
Yeah.
I knew I did. Because, again, if I didn't drink, I was fine. The problem was, as an alcoholic, sometimes I was drinking when I didn't want to drink.
Sure.
In fact, the longer time went on, the older I got, that was more and more the case. So I got into the rehab, and I remember checking in, and the lady checking me in saying, you know, as she did her diagnosis of me, she said, this person suffers from alcoholism. And the word suffers all of a sudden resonated with me, and I said, I am suffering. That's why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
And it hit me across the head, just that alone. Now, going into this place, I didn't have real background in organized religion, spirituality, anything like that. I didn't know the words of the Lord's Prayer until I started going to AA. I didn't know about that stuff. And the rehab I went to preached the 12 steps and some of the principles of AA. So a higher power was very important.
Right.
So I'm walking in there and going, I don't have that. I don't have a higher power. What is that? God? Towards the end of my drinking, I got very curious about other religions, thinking I can find an answer in Eastern philosophies, and I can find an answer here. And then I remember reading Karl Marx saying, man didn't make religion, religion made man. And I went, oh, okay, never mind. You know, and I just kept moving on. But in the rehab, they said, if you really want to stop suffering, you need to find a higher power. You need to find help that's not, it's above all
you.
Of us. It's above me.
Right.
So I became desperate enough, and I was listening to him, and the roommate I had was a South Boston City policeman who was a hardened guy, and we were in the room, and I watched that guy get on his knees, and I thought to myself, well, if he can do it, I can do it. And people told me, your higher power can be whatever you want. That and fake it till you make it were the two things that would go through my head when I'd get there. I said, okay, here I am. I'm faking it.
I'll try it.
I'm trying to make it. Show me. And after 28 days, some things clicked with me. I did 90 days after 90 meetings and 90 days after I got out of rehab.
So AA got you.
It got me. One of the things that got me is one of my old drinking buddies, south of Boston. I'm living in Hillsborough, New Hampshire. He's 2.5 hours away. He drove up to take me to my first AA meeting.
Wow.
He'd been in the program for about 6 years, and he said, I've been waiting for you. He and I used to spend a Saturday night with a case of beer and a bottle of Jack Daniels in his Volkswagen driving around and just talking and drinking.
What was your first meeting like? Did you raise your hand and say, this is my first outside meeting?
I did. It was, meetings were much different in New Hampshire than they are here. And you know, in all honesty, I try to go back and think about them, but I can't. I remember people. I remember I had a sponsor, plus my buddy who came up. I said, well, I guess you're my sponsor. You came. And to this day, he's not my sponsor, but he's a go-to guy for me.
Sure.
So, you know, when I did the 90 and 90, I was going to meetings. I found a group of guys in AA. I found the fellowship.
Yep.
I found the fellowship, and I always was a runner, and so I found a bunch of guys that ran marathons, did triathlons, hanging out with them. Not only am I getting spiritual and emotional, and I'm physically, I'm becoming really good.
So let me ask you a question. In all the midst of all this, is that woman still in your life, the one you were living with?
Oh, man, that's a really good one. No, she's not.
No.
So this woman... Yeah, she was a sweetie. This woman was all about sex and drugs and rock and roll.
Yeah.
She was fun, no question about it, because those were the three things she was into pretty much.
And that was a lifestyle you loved at that point.
Absolutely.
You were using.
Yeah. I'd go out and work all day and then
boom,
go do that.
Party
and
starts.
It was fun. And I had the capacity and the stamina to party till 2, 3 in the morning. And then I had a call at 10 o'clock. I was there.
Yeah.
It may not have looked good or smelled good, but I was there. So anyway, when this girl picked me up, this lady at the rehab, I actually made some friends with a couple guys from Boston. So they came with us, and I said, we got to drop these guys off. We dropped them off. As soon as we dropped them off, we got on the highway. She lit up a joint.
And I looked at her and go,
what the hell?
What are you doing here? I just came out of rehab. Well, that was for alcohol. I go, no, it's everything. You can't smoke. Well, I'm not doing that. I said, immediately, I didn't say it at that point. I said, this is done.
So wow. In your mind, you're saying.
I knew it.
Yeah. You know, you're lucky because a lot of people don't. They fall right back into it.
They do.
You know? Yeah.
But these are the things that I don't know why certain things have happened to me along the way. Now, as I reflect on them, I do know why they happened. But that was it. I knew before we got home, I am not going to. And just like what happens, AA took over my life. I really did immerse myself, the fellowship. I didn't have time for her or going to the bars.
Like, you're driving home, that happens. You're at another turning point.
Yeah.
What am I going to do? Am I going to turn in the direction of sobriety, or am I going to turn in the direction of my old life and my relationship and all that? And you made the good decision.
Because of my higher power, he pointed me in the right direction. And, you know, and you have to understand at this time, I'm still with the same company. We had a warehouse. I worked for a steel mill, but I worked for the warehouse distribution. And my job as an outside salesman had been given away when I was in rehab.
So when you come back, what happens?
I was given a job as back in inside sales. Now, here's the tricky part. I'm living up in my sales territory. The warehouse is down in Massachusetts. I don't have a driver's license, but I got to drive 2 hours each way. For 6 months, I did that.
Just drove illegally?
I drove very illegally.
Yeah.
But I did it. I had illegally attached plates. I had no insurance. But I was sober, and I was just praying, and I got through it, and I think about it. And I read, every morning, I read the...
Reflections.
And the marker in my book is the inspection sticker that I handmade to put in the window to thank the cops.
We are a crafty
bunch. Oh, yeah, I'm telling you. Yeah.
Jeez.
But it's a reminder when I look.
Of
every
course.
Morning I look and go, you remember when you had to
I don't
make
want to go
that?
Back there.
Yeah.
So well, you're sober.
So I'm sober. I'm doing well. My career's taken off. I got a promotion. I move up to where the company's located, up to the headquarters. I'm staying sober. I'm physical. I won the corporate challenge for my corporation 1 year.
I'm running.
I'm doing all this stuff. And then I meet, and I'm going to meetings.
Yeah.
But I'm not finding the guys that I got sober with. But I'm still going to meetings.
Right, because you're in a different city now.
I'm in a different city. I'm in a different state, different city. Yeah. The meetings are different.
You're starting from scratch.
All over again. And so I got up here, but I still went to meetings.
Yeah.
And then I met a woman, and I fell in love, and she was a beautiful woman. And she still is. And then we ended up getting married. And somewhere around that time, the meetings didn't seem to be as important. I didn't seem to have the time. An important thing to tell you is I was still getting on my knees every night. In fact, when my wife and I first got to sleep together, after a couple nights of seeing me doing this, she said, "Do you do that every night?" I said, "I sure do. This is what helps me stay sober."
Hmm.
And that got me lots of brownie points with her, too.
Oh,
I didn't realize
why
I said it, but, you know.
So she was not a big drinker,
I remember talking to my wife. She said, "I remember the one time I got drunk. I didn't like it." I said,
one
time?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, right.
Yep.
No. She came from a family. Her brother is a recovering alcoholic who's also a licensed addiction counselor. She has alcoholism in her family. So she was aware. And I was very forthcoming when I was dating her and told her where I was coming from. So we fast forward. My career's going great. And I got married.
I got this.
I've started a family. I'm coaching soccer. I'm getting promotions. I'm pretty much not going to meetings anymore, but I'm still getting on my knees. I'm thinking that works.
Now, at this point, have you lost touch with your people?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Unless I happened to run into them and I didn't seek anybody out. And this was really before cell phone days, so it's not like I had a bunch of numbers in my pocket.
Couldn't text anybody.
No. So I remember this happening as well, is at some point I stopped getting on my knees at night. And my wife even made a comment. She goes, you don't get on your knees anymore. And I said, I'm praying as I'm laying down.
I'm laying and praying.
Yeah. And one of the things I remember I learned in rehab that I followed was about humility. Get on your knees and be humble. And that stuck with me. So that's why I always got on my knees. And I stopped doing that as well. Well, as things progressed, the company I worked for, which was a 135-year-old company, went bankrupt back in 2008 during the recession. Like a lot of other companies, it was a terrible time for a lot of people. It was a difficult time. Whatever you want to say, I'm not going to say that's the reason I went back to drinking, because if it wasn't that, it would have been something else.
Sure. How much sobriety did you put together?
I had 17 years of sobriety when I went back out.
Can you talk us through your drink, the one that made you go out?
I can. A circumstance happened in my life, and it doesn't matter what it is, because I had none of the tools. I didn't have a toolbox. Well, if we talk about having a toolbox filled, I don't even know where my toolbox was. And I decided, I remember sitting there, I'm gonna drink tonight.
So it was nothing in particular, just... I'm going to revisit I can do it.
I got this. And it's just like the book says, it's just like you hear in the halls. I can go back to drinking normal.
Normally.
I'm going to still get drunk, but I can still craft it so people won't see it.
I can manage it.
Yeah, I'll manage it, right? The first part, no, I'm still going to get drunk, but I'm not going to be unmanageable. That first step was a killer for me.
So
I went back out, and I went back out with vengeance, just like they say. Now, here's the difference. The first time I was drinking, I was in bars. I was party boy. I was having fun. Now I'm back out there, but I'm not telling anybody. I'm not telling my sponsor. I'm not telling my wife.
You're drinking alone?
I'm drinking alone. Not all the time. I have a job where I travel a lot.
Yeah. So as long as you're out of the area code.
And that was one of the things I said, I just won't drink at home.
Oh, my God, you're telling my story again.
I just won't drink at home. So And that was sort of manageable for a while. But then, well, I'll just do, and I know you're a woodworker, and I'm a woodworker, and I always had a bottle of Smirnoff 100 proof in the table saw. And that, I'm going down to the shop for a couple hours. Okay, so I got into the grips of this. This was just terrible.
So would you say it's true that you pick up where you left off?
I picked up even at a higher level.
Yeah, there okay. You go.
You picked up harder.
I picked up harder. Like I said, I had to sneak. So in my mind was, I need something like 100-proof vodka so I can do a couple quick hits.
Yeah, less of it buzz. Does more.
So, yeah, less
so
does
did,
more.
Did your wife at the time have no idea that you were drinking again?
In the very beginning, she did not. Mm. She knew something was wrong,
yeah.
But she had never seen me drunk before. Uh-huh. So she couldn't pinpoint what it was.
Did the thought that I'm having to hide this already. Did that touch something in you that said, this is not going to be good? Or were you just like, the denial was so strong, you're like, I'll be fine.
The denial was that strong.
Yeah.
It really was. And also at the time, it was justified in the fact that my company was going bankrupt.
Of course.
I was an upper executive, so I was in the thick of it. I was also part of the team that had to try to sell this company. And so while that was going on, you know, I'm drinking. I'm functioning. I'm doing
getting some
okay.
ease and comfort from it.
Yeah, yeah. And it progresses like they say. And,
yeah.
And it was terrible. When my wife finally figured out what was going on, I jumped in and out of meetings. And honestly, I did it to appease her.
Yeah.
Then I half the time I said I was going to a meeting, but I went to a bar. And and I could never go to a local bar because I can't be seen.
Mm.
I'm drinking incognito.
And you know, all that lying is just, it's like all the juggling of
God.
The details.
It makes me stressed out thinking about
Very stressful.
It gets better. So when the company I was working for went bankrupt in 2008, it was a difficult time. As everybody in 2008, it was the worst recession I think any of us have gone through, unless you're about 100 years old. and so at the end of it, the company I worked for had 10 warehouses around the country that did not get picked up in the bankruptcy. So I spent a lot of time, I wrote a business plan for these warehouses, and I spent time pitching it to other steel mills. I flew to Europe. I used to go overseas a lot, and I knew a lot of people. But remember, 2008, liquidity was zero. People were not partying.
Yeah, I was in the home building materials industry,
yeah.
And it just died. No.
Well, I was lucky enough to find a guy down in Dallas who was a millionaire and an opportunistic guy, and he saw the bankruptcy, and he ended up buying the assets, and we had 10 warehouses, a whole bunch of inventory, and we had 90 people. And these 90 people were all former employees with a lot of experience, years of experience in the industry, and colleagues of mine. I'd worked with a lot of these people 20-plus years. So bottom line was, this guy came up with the money, bought the company, and then came to me to run it.
And yeah, you're still drinking through this whole thing.
Oh, I'm drinking. Yeah, yeah. Nobody knows this. These guys, when they met me, I was presented as a recovering alcoholic. He doesn't drink. They were all cool with it. You know, I'll tell you, during my career, I spent a lot of time flying overseas to do business. And in Asia, China, Japan, drinking is a huge part
of
doing business.
Yes. Oh, gosh,
particularly
yes.
After the business. And it's a trust-building event. And back in the day when I worked for this company and I was sober, it took a long time for me to build the relationships with
because
these guys.
Because you weren't
drinking. Because I wasn't drinking. I mean, I'd go to Russia and Ukraine one time. One time in Ukraine, my buddy was putting water in my shot glass so I could go shot to shot with him. They thought I was the greatest drinker in the world, and I was, but you just don't really see me drinking the real thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they got to know me, and I got to do business with people in the countries. And I even knew a guy in China who didn't drink, and he and I became good friends, and that was rare. So fast forward, this guy buys a company. I get my first shot. This reminds me of the soccer game when I was drunk. Here I get my shot to build a company. I'm taking the phoenix from the ashes, right? Putting 90 people back to work in the greatest recession that we've ever faced. And we did. We built that company back up. In 10 years, we had 1 year we weren't profitable. The first few years, our businesses increased in double digits until we got to about 32% market share. We leveled out. The whole time I'm drinking. And now I'm flying, doing a lot of business overseas. And, you know, I got to be American Airlines Platinum, an executive platinum. And guess what comes along with that kind of privilege?
Free booze!
Free alcohol. So I'm in a position now where I'm traveling, and basically every time I go near an airport, someone is saying, here's some free drinks. Whether it's in a lounge or it's in a first class, 7 a.m, you can get a drink in first class. I'm not saying I did that every time, but there were times I'd show up in Chicago for a meeting and I had a buzz on. I go, I'll be okay. I can manage. It's just a bank meeting. I can deal with this. So somehow I got through doing this. There's an important part of the story I want to tell you, because when I said before, sometimes I wonder why I'm still here. In September of 1994, I was in Chicago, and it was a Friday night, and I had a ticket on US Air, which back then US Air went to Pittsburgh and then to Syracuse. They didn't go direct. And a buddy said, hey, I got a United ticket here. It's direct. You want it? I said, yeah. And back then, you could switch tickets and do whatever. So I got home that night, and when I got home, my answer machine's lit up. And it's my boss, it's our administrative assistant, it's my dad, and I go, who's now my wife, was my girlfriend. I go, why are they all calling me? Well, that flight I was supposed to be on, it crashed, and everybody died.
Oh, wow.
Shit.
And, you know, during that time, it never sunk in, but in this second round of sobriety, it's like, okay, you've kept me here for a reason. And I'll get into that later. It's about service work, I believe. But and so that happened. So fast forward, I'm doing well with this company. I ran that company for 10 years. I was drinking a lot, but I am a functioning alcoholic. I really am.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, my family life sucks. I don't even see it because my life is manageable. I'm putting 2 kids through college. I paid off a mortgage. I took care of I'm taking care of everything. How is my life unmanageable? Show me where it is. So, but in the meantime, the relationship with my wife is not good. My kids, I think my son told my wife to leave me a few times. So the alcoholism was taking the effect on the family, but I didn't see that part.
Right.
I didn't see it. I really didn't. Because in my mind, I justified it because I'm bringing home the bacon and taking care of everything.
Right.
And I look at me, I'm working my ass. I'm flying all over the world for
so
you.
So your
guys.
Alcoholism is fully active at this
point. It's very,
and then
ablaze.
Something changes, right?
Well, something changes. So in 2019, I came to heads with my boss. He wasn't pleased enough with our growth. We went from double-digit growth to because we plateaued when we hit our market share gain back. So he decided to give me help, and I didn't appreciate having the help. And basically my line was, there's too many cooks in the kitchen. I'm done. I gave a 3-month notice, and I resigned. I did the math. Both my kids were done with school. I'm in good shape. I'm done with this. I was burnt out. I didn't want to travel anymore. I was just done with it. So what happened in 2020? I started consulting. I know a lot of stuff here, and people want to know what I know. I found out I can make a lot of money doing this. And it was going pretty good. Still drinking, still doing my traveling. You know, now I'm traveling on my own company and this and that. Then COVID hit and shut everything down.
Mm-hmm.
And I went from going 90 miles an hour to getting 100 emails a day to, you know, this life to 2 dogs telling me when it's time for lunch. You know, that was my
one
life.
Way to put it.
Drastic change.
Yeah. It was nothing.
What does that do to your drinking?
Well, isn't that interesting? It took off, right? Now, so one thing I decided to do when I retired was I better do something. I can't sit here and drink all day. So I did volunteer work. I started delivering for Meals on Wheels, and I did some volunteer work at our local senior center. And my routine was I had 3 days a week I was out there, and I would pick up my meals. I'd go to these apartments, deliver like 5 here, stop at the liquor store, put the bottle of vodka in the cooler because I got rid of those meals. Now there's room for it, and finish my morning. And I did that for a while.
So you were a professional drunk driver.
I was a professional drunk driver, but again, how is my life unmanageable? I'm helping these people.
Yeah.
Right. Your alcoholism will always find a way to justify everything.
So what if I drink?
Protect itself.
Look what I do here. Yeah. Look what I'm doing. So on December 16, 2022, that was the date you first asked for. It was a Friday. It was a very snowy morning. 9 o'clock, I went over to pick up my meals. Now, when I drank, it was always best for me to finish the whole bottle because the chances were the next morning, because of the hangover and there was no available alcohol, I'd get through that day and probably not drink.
Mm. You're better man than I.
Well, but if there was like a third of a bottle
you'd
left,
you'd start drinking again.
That was terrible because that third isn't going to last me, so now I got to go back to a bottle. And that was the case. So that Friday morning, before I got to the apartments, I had that down, and I stopped. I got my deliveries done, and I'm driving, and I remember this vividly, thinking, is it all right to swear on this? Yeah.
Right. Oh, yeah.
I'm fucked.
Yeah.
I'm fucked. I'm going to die from this disease.
That you
I
are
am not going to. Because
in the grips.
You know what? I'm going to get another bottle of vodka. I don't want to.
Yeah.
I don't want to do this, but I'm going to go get another bottle of vodka. I'm going to keep. And I did. And I remember walking in that liquor store going, okay, you know what? I surrendered, if you will, to the disease. And so I got in my truck and I drove some more. And then I'm going down a road very close to my house. It's a county route. And my truck hit a woman and knocked her car off the road.
Oh, I hit a car.
I hit another car.
I thought you hit a woman.
I'm sorry. She was in her car. Yeah,
okay.
Knocked her off
Thank
the
God.
Road. Yeah, really, because it's snowing. There's, I don't know, 4 inches of slush on the road. And so I decide I'm not going to deal with this, so I keep going. And then I drive this way, and I said, nah, I'm going to go home. So I turn around, went the other way, and the next thing I know, my truck is sitting on top of a cement wall, destroyed. All the airbags are off. I'm on the outside, and there's state police standing in front of me. And that's when I decided, thank you, Lord. I'm going to do it. I'm going to kill myself. This is it. And when and I was...
Yeah, it wasn't you're going to stop drinking.
No, I wasn't
going to
stop. I'm done for good. I'm defeated. I can't do this anymore. I can't. Now, here's the part that kills me. I had 17 years of sobriety.
Yeah.
The miracles came true in my life in that time. So I know this program works, right?
Yep.
All that time I was out there, it was like almost 13 years, I was suffering knowing it was here, but I couldn't get back here.
Mm.
It took me doing what I did on that snowy day to get me back here. But that's not what got me here. I got processed. Here's another higher power thing. I blew a 1.7. 1.8 is aggravated DWI. 1.7 is a misdemeanor. It went from a felony to a misdemeanor.
Very small margin.
Half hour later, I'm there.
Yeah.
Because I had a bottle of vodka in the truck. And people say, oh, 1.7, that's not much. This is 1 o'clock in the afternoon.
Right.
You know, by 5 o'clock, trust me, I got a 3 in there somewheres. And so I was taken down to the station, processed all that, very cooperative. The arresting officer was another woman, state police officer. Her name was Knight. And she kept saying how nice I was. She goes, you're one of the nicest guys. Most people are. I said, I'm good. I'm fine. You know, she had no clue what's going through my head.
Right.
So I get home. I had a friend pick me up, and I get home. My wife is working, and she comes home, and the first question is, where's your truck? Well, I got in an accident. You got in an accident. What happened? I said, well, and I made up a story.
Yeah.
And she goes, well, how's the truck? I said, the truck's total. It's destroyed. Okay. Didn't tell her anything about the DWI.
The arrest.
This is Friday. This is on a Friday. Saturday morning, I got up. Now, I also have to add this. This is December 16th. Christmas is like... I have a son in the military. He's down in Norfolk. He's coming home for Christmas. My daughter's coming home for Christmas.
And are you still planning to off yourself?
Yeah.
He's getting there. Yeah.
Okay. I'm getting there.
Okay.
But I also wanted to say that because, you know, they have no clue.
Right. No one has any clue.
Nobody. I mean, they do, but they don't. So yeah, I'm thinking. So Saturday morning, my wife goes off to work. I wrote a letter to my daughter, my son, my wife, my brother, and to the arresting officer. And it was pretty much saying, I've had enough, blah, 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 whatever. I went down in the basement. We like to shoot, and we have a 20-gauge used shotgun, easy to use. Went outside because I didn't want to make a mess. And then I started thinking, man, if I miss and I'm a vegetable, that's worse for my wife. That's not good. My wife has a BMW i28 convertible 6-speed. It's a guilt gift that I gave her 1 year for Christmas. She got a lot of good gifts when I was drinking. And it's sitting in our garage. So I think asphyxiation, that's a lot easier. So I go for the key to the car. It's not there. So I called my wife. I said, where's the key to the BMW? I have it. Why? I said, well, I just wanted to start it, make sure it's running. And I said, where's the spare? Carly, our daughter, has it. I said, shit. So I can't do it that way either. So I opened the garage door, and as I'm doing it, Officer Black is pulling up my driveway. And now I'm going, oh, this is great. What's this going to be? And so we started talking, and she looked at me, and she said, my body camera's off. I said, okay. She started telling me about her brother who had an opioid addiction that ended up dying of an overdose, and her mother finding him in a Section 8 apartment. She said, this is in all the families. She and I talked for about a half hour. And when she left, I didn't want to kill myself anymore. My
Your
higher
power yes.
sent
oh,
this yeah. woman to me. And I went to a meeting Sunday night. It was my first meeting. I rose my hand. Couple people in there looked at me and said, I remember you, because I did bop in and out of those meetings. And I surrendered. I was done. I
remember
in tears.
You coming back
in
yeah,
the
I do too.
I couldn't talk. I was in tears.
Yep. I got to tell you, when you came back, your message
it
hit hard.
Oh, big time.
Like, I, you know, the way
For
you
a
spoke,
lot of people.
I felt your pain.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's a pain we've had. We both had. Yeah. All three of us have had. And when you were speaking, I was like, holy shit, that's so real, you know?
It was, it was divine intervention that got me back here. There's no question. I mean, I was desperate. You know, we talk about, you know, the gift of desperation. I told you, I was sitting there the whole time thinking this won't, you know, every time I turned on the TV, I saw William Mahar, you know, if you've been in a car accident, here's your lawyers. I'm going, I'm going to get sued. I screwed, and I said, and I deserve it. I hit this one.
Yeah.
You know, I screwed up. But I also started to work the fellowship. I got a sponsor within the first 2 weeks. I went right back to the steps. Now, the first time through, I read the big book myself. Mm. Now I read it with other people, mm-hmm. and I get stuff out of it. I kind of did the steps, you know, a four-step. Back then is a lot different than a four-step when you have a wife and kids and so much more happened in your life.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I've taken the program very seriously this time through. And I go to a lot of meetings.
A lot of people.
Right, we're talking about service work.
Service work is, you know, I have the triangle and the circle on the back of my truck. Unity, service, recovery. I'm retired. I'm very lucky. What I also have learned through this fellowship. One of the things my sponsor gave me, go back to spirituality, I still lacked real understanding of spirituality, I think. I'm learning, and it tells us that, right? We're
yeah.
learning every day.
Yes.
But he gave me four prayers that he suggested I read every day. The Serenity Prayer, the Third Step, Seventh Step, and the St. Francis Prayer. That's the one that resonates with me every day. And I still work in the senior center. And what I've learned is when I'm out of self, when I'm helping somebody in AA, these people aren't in AA, but I'm helping them, I'm not, nothing's bothering.
Right, you're fine.
I'm fine.
Hmm. Yeah.
I'm fine. I found serenity again. Have the promises come true? Not yet.
Yeah.
You know, I have a long way to go still. But being back in the field, I found the guys again. You guys are the guy.
There you go.
I mean, they were always there.
Of course.
I just didn't see
That's them. The thing, yeah. If you want to find them, you will. If you don't want to find them, you're never going to find
That's
them.
That's right.
They aren't going to chase you.
So right. you had a 10-year drinking career before you got sober the first time?
The first time I started at 15, and I got sober around 30.
Okay, so about 15 years. And then how much sobriety?
I had 17 years.
Then you went back out for?
Like 13 or something like that, and now I'm a year and 3 months.
Nice. Yeah, and, it's rare that somebody is out that long, comes back, and has the gift of desperation again the second time
right,
around.
Right, after that amount of time,
and gets
too.
It. And now when you look back, you're like, Jesus, why did I do that for so long to myself?
Oh, you know, what gets me, and this is my journey. This is the way it was supposed to go. But I do the old, you know, I ran a successful company. I was the president and CEO. Nobody questioned me, you know. If I said, I'm leaving, okay, bye.
You're the boss.
Slip out anytime I wanted to.
Meanwhile, who was really the president and CEO?
But guess what? What could have happened had I had my wits about me?
Right.
You know, and I should have, could have, would have, you know.
Yeah, I know.
But that's okay.
We shall not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it, right?
No, absolutely. And you know, what I find is if I spend too much time in the past, I will get depressed.
Yeah.
If I spend too much time in the future, I start projecting, I get anxious. You never project in a positive fashion.
No.
So staying right here in the moment.
Boy,
you know, like
one day at a time is the key, isn't it? It really is.
And like the meeting tonight that we were at, you're right. And you called on me, and the reason I didn't share is I have a situation with my son that would have taken way too long, and I wanted to listen. And when I listened, a lot of things became apparent to me. And that's the way this works. My higher power talks to me through the group, and you know, I'm not gonna say every person in that room had something to say that worked for me.
Yeah.
But you know, that's the other beauty of it.
Yeah. If you walk away with one, that's the magic.
And I always do.
Yep.
You know, I say this, I always feel better walking out of an AA meeting than I do when I walk in.
Yep. You heard it from the guy who's been up, down, and back up.
No.
So.
Yep. And here's the thing, if I don't, and it happens more than once, I get the app out and find another meeting.
There you go.
That's right.
And you know, there's plenty to go to, and it's just been, I can't say enough about it. I am truly blessed. That's why I said I should have been dead. My drunk driving career was incredible over the years, the cars I wrecked.
Yeah, but I will say this. We're truly blessed to have you here today. We're at the end of our time, but we want to thank you so much for coming in, sharing your story with us.
Yes.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So until next time on the Glumlot Podcast, I'm Mark.
I am Brett.
I'm Peter.
As we wrap up another episode of the Glumlot Podcast, we want to extend our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in today. Navigating the path to recovery from alcohol and other substances is a journey filled with challenges, triumphs, and self-discovery. Remember, we're not affiliated with Alcoholics Anonymous, but we're here to provide a safe space for open conversations about the complexities of recovery. Your stories, courage, and resilience inspire us and our listeners alike. If you or someone you know is on the transformative journey, know that you're not alone. Join us next time as we continue to explore the diverse facets of recovery. Until then, stay strong, stay connected, and remember that each day is a step towards a brighter, sober tomorrow. Thank you for being part of the Glumlot community.